It's time for the show that brings the magic right to your speakers. Ears Up!
Hey, welcome everybody. Ears Up Podcast. I almost started saying our website. Earsup-podcast.com, guys. Welcome. And we're rebranding. We're embracing all of our mistakes in the past. And, you know...
In college, I performed at the MicronPC.com Bowl. That was one of the lesser bowl games.
I love it, man. I love it. Fond memories of the .com bloom.
Yes.
I guess. I don't know. Anyway, welcome, everybody. I'm glad you're here. For those of you watching on YouTube, don't worry. Taryn will be here. Bev is out sick. She promises it's not COVID. Terrence is, Terrence has work to do or something like that, so he can't join us either. So it's a Beverly and Terrence-less show, which I'm disappointed in, to be honest with you, because number one, I like those guys. But number two, this is going to be a great show for them specifically. It is the history of Star Tours. And Terrence would really appreciate some of the history in here and some of the audio clips that I have and some of the video that I'm going to throw up there, because I do have one piece of video to show people on YouTube, and I'll cut it out of the podcast, but it's just too important in the history to like not show, right? But anyway, so I'm disappointed, but I'm also overjoyed because it allows me the opportunity to bring Eric and Rob on.
Hello.
Of course, from the Supreme Resort and Bantha Milk, respectively. Welcome, boys. Welcome, lads.
Are you saying that I'm not going to appreciate some of the audio and history and clips that you have?
No, I think you will. But when I was writing the show, I specifically had interactions with Terrence playing out in my head.
Yeah, that old rapport. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. But it's fine. I'm glad you guys are here because I think you'll like it. And Rob, you know, we were talking just a little bit ago before we started the show that it's Star Wars week, basically. So we got to have the Star Wars guy on.
That's right. That's me. I'm the Star Wars guy.
Well, I was going to say Nick couldn't join us. So
Nick knows more than I do. He said no. And then Jason asked me, and I was the one dumb enough to say, sure, let's do this super late at night on a weeknight.
That's right. He's like, no, I would join you, but I have to make pancakes and play the saxophone.
That's right.
Saxophone. Anyway, so it is the history of Star Tours. And let me tell you, I've been working on this show for like the past week. Awesome. I am very excited about it. I thought, Star Tours, I don't know. We're going to need a new segment, come up with it. There's a ton in here that I didn't know about Star Tours, so I'm excited to share it with everybody. But first, you can find us on social media, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest. If you have anything to say to us, you can use the web form on our website, which is earsup-podcast.com, or send it to me, Jason, earsup-podcast.com. Whatever you want to do, we'll take anything you want to send. That's fine. Concierge, you guys, if you're going to any of the parks now, as things are sort of, opening up for everybody and people are really starting to get into the parks and really sort of feel like the old days, Concierge is your best bet to navigate that whole nonsense. They will sell you tickets to get into the park at park prices. They're not charging you anything else to get into the park, but they have all of their services available to you. Stuff that you can't just get by calling that dumb Disney dining line or whatever. You're sitting on hold for whatever. No one wants to be sitting on hold listening to that music, the same music over and over again, for like half an hour. You're sitting in the park. You want to be going doing stuff, right?
Do you know who does want to spend time sitting and listening to that hold music?
Concierge.
It's Concierge. We love that hold music. We will sit and listen to it for you. Book a package through us and all that extra waiting on hold. That's on us then. It's complimentary.
Yeah, that's on me, dog. You know, honestly, I still refuse to think that that's what you guys do. I think that you have some sort of portal or back end or like, you know, whatever.
Secret bat phone. And,
yes.
Line in. Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that.
We wish. Really, the only reason that we have a slight competitive advantage.
I love advantages.
Over you, the average user, is that we're calling, we'll wait on hold for half an hour to book like four different families. So that's the only advantage we have.
Oh, you sell in bulk, basically.
No, we don't.
Or whatever. I'm just kidding. No.
We wait on hold in bulk.
Yes, that's what I mean. Yeah, that's where I was going with that, is that there's some bulk thing to it. Just because
it's a little more efficient that way. Yeah, that's what we're going for. We had our monthly meeting earlier tonight, and yeah, that's kind of the gist of it. We spend a lot of time waiting for you.
A lot of time on hold. Well, I know there are millions of people who appreciate it.
Yes.
Yes, millions.
Yeah, I'm sure. I don't know. Whatever. I don't know.
Or they will appreciate it.
That's
right.
Can
you do the same thing for my insurance company? Can you wait on hold? That would be amazing.
Does your insurance company pay me?
It's a new thing called Concy Insurance.
Concy Insurance.
Yeah. Anyway.
The pun doesn't work as well, but sure. No, why
it's not? Fine, man. You can support the show. Support the network, I should say. All of this, helps to keep everybody on board here. But you can head over to Etsy.com/shop/Covered. You can buy a bunch of churro shirts and the ride shirts and the turkey leg shirts. We have a whole bunch of stuff. What I think I'm going to do maybe next week is start putting up more tank tops, maybe more muscle tees.
Oh,
it's getting summer. You know what I mean?
My guns.
Yeah, you got to do that, Rob. You got to do it. You got to pull them out and get some sun on those things.
Sun on the guns.
Yes, that's right. But the best way to support us, of course, is through Patreon. Go to patreon.com/earsup. And for as little as $5 a month, you can get access to The Secret Show, which we're going to be doing here in a couple of weeks. You have the back catalog of Secret Shows and all the other little shows that we've done, like cool people doing cool things. I should probably do at some other time. Pyramid Eye the Ears, which I'm in the middle of writing another one too. And so we got a whole thing going on. But patreon.com/earsup. That's the best way. Hi, Taryn. Welcome to the show.
Hi, everyone. Nice to see everybody.
Hey.
It is nice to be seen.
Yes.
I didn't know if you were talking to us or, your millions of listeners out there in podcast land.
Well, first of all, Rob, it's billions.
I apologize.
Rob. The 21st Amendment Brewery's latest beer release, Tropical Brew Free or Die IPA, puts an island vacation in their whimsically designed cans. That's right, cans. This refreshing year-round release, Tropical IPA, is brewed with pale and Munich malts, brimming with Azaka, Citra Cryo, and Mosaic hops, and topped with a splash of pineapple flavor. The result is a clean, refreshing beer featuring a mix of sweet malt, balanced bitterness, fruit-forward hops, and a nice tropical vacation at the finish. Tropical Brew For Your Die IPA is available at your local good beer shop, neighborhood taproom, and anywhere else people come together to find great craft beer.
That's right. They sure do, everybody.
Can I tell you, I walked through the hallways going, in cans. That's right,
cans. At your school?
At my school, yeah. And people look at me, they're like, what is wrong with you? I'm like, never mind.
Yeah. Kids, throw those away in the garbage cans. That's right, cans.
That's right. That's awesome.
That'd be a great thing to bring to your school.
That will be, yes.
Okay, well, that's about it. We were going to, like I said, have Bev talk about her trip and, do a bunch of other stuff too, but unfortunately she's not feeling good, so we're gonna let her off the hook this time. But our next show will have another Budget Bev Part 2, I believe is what we're going to be calling it, and it'll be good. But for now, are you guys ready for the history of Star Tours?
Yes.
Yes.
All right.
I've never been more ready for something.
I feel that this is going to be lengthy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because you've been working on it a lot.
I really have, man. Well, look, I was trying to do it in time for May the 4th, which was yesterday. But now it's May the 6th. Is that the new thing, Rob?
Yes. Sith. Yes. May the 5th is May the 6th. You
okay.
are correct.
Okay. See you later, Cinco de Mayo.
Yeah. And George Lucas's birthday is coming up very soon, if it's not today as well. So there's a lot of things in May all based around Star Wars. So.
Okay. Yes. I love it. Well, especially this show. It's perfect timing.
It's perfect timing.
So let's take a break. Let's take a step back away from the parks we know and love today. And let's go back and think about the parks in the 70s and 80s. Specifically, the Disney company in the movie theaters. Now, the late 70s to mid 80s was a pretty hard time for Disney at the box office. Films like 1979's The Black Hole, which is commonly referred to as Disney's answer to Star Wars, but had actually been in production since like 1975. So it's sort of like predated Star Wars. But anyway, The Black Hole didn't really connect with audiences. I think the budget was like $28 million and it made like $32 million at the box office. It didn't lose money, but it was not a success. It was not the success that the company was looking for, especially not after Star Wars came through in 1977 and made space kind of cool again. You know what I mean? At the time, the company was producing sequels to a lot of their shows. This might sound familiar. Sequels like Herbie Goes Bananas. I'm sure everyone remembers that one.
Everyone.
I actually do.
Okay, well, there you go. The Apple Dumpling Gang Rides Again.
No, I don't. Yep.
Okay.
Okay. And Return from Witch Mountain. They just were not scratching audiences where they itched.
Sounds familiar.
Right? As much as Disney needed a new class of films, Disneyland needed a new class of attraction. And there was a desire to have rides based on Disney movies, of course, in the parks. If Disney films weren't popular, if they weren't creating truly engaging movies, well, there would not be any new characters, new locations, storylines, or dramas to base any new park additions on. Big Thunder Railroad opened in September of 1979, and it sounds like after that experience, Imagineering was just sort of hard up for new ideas, or at least ones geared towards existing IP. Because Big Thunder was based on, you know, their sort of old existing ride. Nothing really new has happened based on Disney IP in a little bit. At about 1983, Tony Baxter, Imagineer extraordinaire, approached Ron Miller, then Disney CEO, and told him as much. He said, look, man, Imagineering is kind of in trouble right now. There's no audience interest in the current slate of Disney films. Nothing Disney made at the box office was working, and the parks were in danger of becoming even more irrelevant than they were. I mean, that's sort of risky, I think, on Baxter's behalf to go to his boss and be like, you guys aren't giving me anything. I can't work with this. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I can't be an Imagineer. I can't make stuff up based on these movies that nobody cares about if you want me to make movies or if you want to make rides on about movies that people care about.
Well, talk about IP in the parks. Yeah, imagine a time when nobody cares about it. Although, I mean, more people should have cared about the black hole. I just want to go on record and say, if you ever wanted to see a robot go to hell,
you know,
that's
what
the movie for you.
Honestly, I was watching a couple trailers online to see about pulling some some audio for this to give the audience a little bit of insight as to what the, but it wasn't, nothing that I found was like relatable, or it wasn't a relatable in an audio format. It was like visual also, but it did look pretty cool. I'll be honest with you, I'm sort of surprised at like how poorly it performed at the box office.
It's a trip.
I remember as a kid actually liking it, because the one robot that was like, I don't know what his name was, but it was like a floating robot, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like cute. And like 79, I was like seven. So at 7 years old, you see a cool robot that's floating, you want one, you know? So I was like, well, that's cool.
Move aside, BB-8.
Yeah, exactly. So I remember liking it back then. And then I did rewatch it after I was watching something about, you know, Black Hole, and I was like, oh, I wonder if it's on Disney Plus. And sure enough, it is. So then I was rewatching it. And I mean, in my opinion, it didn't stand up, but it was very, for its time, very good, like graphic wise and special effects and stuff like that. It was really, really cool. But trying to rewatch it was tough.
Yeah, I can imagine. And especially, you know, I mean, imagine you're the writers where, first of all, I was reading the history about that script a little bit because it's sort of tied in. And that script was sort of passed around Hollywood to sort of fix it up. It wasn't really the greatest script in the entire universe, you know, anyway. And the people who wrote it were sort of more geared to disaster films. So they were like, well, how about a disaster film in space? And that's how where we sort of came up with it. But like up to that point, space movies were either way out fantasy or this sort of like weird melodrama, and Star Wars came and just totally changed everything. So at that point, you can't do anything. You know, Star Wars is here like, okay, we'll try to make our space movie. And I just don't think it just screws the pacing up. I think it changed, you know, dramatically. But so the two men, Baxter and Miller, agreed that they needed to bring in some outside help. Imagineering needed help. The Disney film division needed help. We need to do something with the parks. Nothing's going in. Imagineering are tapped out of ideas. Well, who were the two biggest names in Hollywood at the time? Ones that had proven success in delivering what audiences want? George Lucas and Steven Spielberg. Baxter and Miller thought Steven Spielberg was the obvious choice to help the parks out, but since he had heavy connections with Universal, which of course is a Disney competitor, they reached out to George Lucas instead. That's sort of my inference from this conversation. So a lot of this information Some of it I got from Behind the Attraction, that show on Disney Plus. They have a whole one on Star Tours, which somehow it's labeled Star Tours, but somehow it goes into like Star Wars land at like the last 10 minutes. I'm like, what do you guys? And I was trying to watch that show. It was kind of like bad. It's just like the narration. It's almost like geared for teens, where it's like, keep it light. And they have like sound effects and jokes and stuff. It's like, what are you?
It sounds very Disney.
It's not. I didn't really like it. But anyway,
I don't like it as much as the Imagineering story that okay. I loved.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Now, I've read differing accounts about how George Lucas and Disney first started talking about doing a ride together. The show Behind the Attraction on Disney Plus makes it sound like Tony just approached George Lucas, like he just walked up to him in, like, you know, Ralph's. It was like, George, I got a thing for you. But other sources say it was Marty Sklar who first set up that meeting between the two. However, according to George Lucas, he'd been chasing Disneyland for the opportunity to work on Tomorrowland, and it was they that accepted his offer. Here's George. Clip three, please, Jason. Okay, thanks.
Well, for a long time I've been interested in trying to get involved with the Disneyland theme park. And for years I, you know, discussed it with the management at Disney, and eventually it came about that they accepted my offer to be involved, and that we would sort of combine ideas. I wanted to have an involvement in Tomorrowland. I thought that was a portion of the park that had always been a little less than what it could have been. And so they've given me the opportunity to include my characters into that part of the park and try to come up with some new ideas.
First of all, can you sound a little excited?
No, I know.
Just a little bit.
He sounds bored of himself. He's like, oh, I have to listen to George Lucas talk again.
Come and this on. Is like 1987, I think, is when he was. I think this interview was done in conjunction with the opening of Star Tours. But two things. Number one, he's been pestering them for the opportunity because he thought Tomorrowland stunk.
Which it did.
And it's like, wow, that's sort of ballsy. You got hired by Disney to do this, and you're like, well, sort of less than what it could be. Yeah, well, I don't know. Anyway, yeah. Good on George Lucas, I guess.
Yeah. Do you know why? Like, why? I mean, I know he wanted to be... What was his connection to Disneyland? Do we know?
He apparently, I think I have it in my notes here, but I'll tell you in case I deleted it and rearranged it and didn't put it back. He was at Disneyland on the second day it opened.
Oh, right. Wow.
Apparently, he was such a big fan of Disneyland. He was there and his family went all the time, and he was like, it was really important to him. And he's like, even then, I knew that it sort of stunk and I wanted to make it better.
Gotcha.
Cool. Yeah.
Okay.
But the story about how George Lucas gets involved is sort of deeper than just... They accepted my offer, Marty Sklar set it up, and bada bing, bada boom. Way back again in 1979, sort of where we started, Michael Eisner was head of Paramount Studios. At the same time, George Lucas was running around Hollywood pitching a deal for his next film. The deal started to get a nickname, this Killer Deal, because it was just...
Cool nickname.
Yeah, because it was death for any studio that would take it, which was basically the studio fronts all of the money for this new movie. They take all of the risk with distribution, and then Lucas gets all the best parts of the back end points. Well, eventually, this killer deal landed on Eisner's desk, who read it and said it was, yeah, it's an unmakeable deal. This cannot be made. But the script that was attached to the deal was also the best script he had ever read. Not to mention, the project had not only George Lucas, but Steven Spielberg on board. He'd seen what Star Wars had already done at the box office, and so he greenlit what was to be the instant classic Raiders of the Lost Ark, giving George Lucas the sweetheart deal he'd been so adamant on having. Fast forward to 1984. Michael Eisner comes on board at the Disney company after Ron Miller leaves. Eisner needs to make a splash right away to breathe new life into the parks and the brand as a whole, basically. And that conversation between Tony Baxter and Ron Miller that happened previous year, 1983, had never really been forgotten. And when Eisner took over, Lucas was even more of a natural fit since he already had those tasty connections from booking the Raiders deal. And in fact, the Lucas brand was such a thirst trap for Disney management at the time that they approached George Lucas to run the company before even reaching out to Michael Eisner. George Lucas could have been the CEO of Disney.
Wow.
But he just didn't want to run a theme park is what his answer was. It's just not what he wanted to do.
I'm trying to imagine if that would have been a good thing or a bad thing?
I know.
I really don't know.
For me, as bad as that sounds to have like a revisionist at the helm, which is what Lucas is. I mean, come on. It might not have been so terrible. And I think as we go on down the history, you'll see why. So anyway, Eisner gets installed. He's CEO, 1984. He starts reaching out to his buddy George Lucas for ride ideas and anything that could sort of help the parks, you know, perk up a little bit. And once more, he opens the company wallet and gives George Lucas yet another sweetheart deal. For every George Lucas-originated project, Lucas would get $1 million per attraction, per park that it was in, per year that it was running.
So that's like basically in perpetuity then. Like you don't take a ride out.
You're printing money, bro. You're literally printing money. You get $1 million per year, per park, per attraction. Like, now, that's it.
At this point in time, how many parks? Was there just the two parks at this point in time? Was it just
It was Disney three. World? There was Disneyland, Disney World, and Tokyo.
Tokyo, okay.
And Paris. So, oh, at the time, 84? Yeah, I don't know. Not Paris, right? Paris is 90s?
90s, yeah. I think.
So
he's getting $3 million a year just because he created a ride.
Just off rip, yeah.
Nice.
This arrangement even applied to later attractions. So anything he thought up of later, such as Indiana Jones and the Temple of Peril at Disneyland Paris, Indiana Jones Adventure, Temple of the Crystal Skull at Tokyo Disney Sea, Indiana Jones in Disneyland. I mean, it's just guys
making
money. He's
like a contract wizard.
Yeah.
Like, how did he get anyone to sign this?
I don't know, man. Well, Eisner, I mean, he wanted new blood into the parks, and boy, did he get it.
Wow.
So all George Lucas has to say is, well, why don't we do a stunt show at the new MGM park?
Yeah.
Nope. Right.
Here's another million.
Eric, you were a little too excited about that. You were a little, bring it down. Yeah. At a National Fantasy Fan Club meeting, which apparently is a thing, in July of 1988, legendary Imagineer David Mumford, whose work includes the Land Pavilion at Epcot Center and the Mermaid Lagoon section of Tokyo Disney Sea, spoke of a cutting-edge Star Wars roller coaster that was originally proposed for this Eisner-Lucas conjunction. So this is what was slated. Lucas signs on. He starts talking to Imagineering. This is the idea that was originally presented to George at the very first meeting. The idea was a thrill ride. It was a roller coaster, but it had choice points in the story. So you get in the coaster, and as you ascend the lift hill, right, which is the hill that brings you all the way up to like get you the momentum to ride the roller coaster, as you ascend the lift hill, two holograms appear. You have Yoda on the left and Emperor Palpatine on the right. Each character would try and persuade the riders in the car to join either the light side or the dark side of the Force. And each seat in front of them would have a light-up panel so its riders could literally vote on which side of the Force to drift towards. I think that's pretty cool, man.
Yeah, I like that.
Cool. That's very cool.
Well, the issue of space quickly knocked that out of the park because in order to have a roller coaster with at least two versions of itself, right? So if you pick the Yoda side, you would go and you would see characters from the light side of the movies. If you saw the Emperor Palpatine, you went to the dark side, you would see Darth Vader and all these people like that. So it's essentially two versions of this roller coaster.
Okay.
That would have to be built basically together. Huh. So you have the roller coaster with at least two versions of itself, plus the mechanics that would allow for the safe transitioning between tracks, depending on what the guests voted on. I mean, you're at the crest of this hill and the track has to switch depending on whatever it does. Right. It would have been massive. The idea of a coaster seems natural. Their most successful rides at this point, Disney, Space Mountain, Big Thunder, had all been elaborate roller coasters. So why not keep doing the same exact thing?
Because it's the same exact thing.
And it's sort of like how they got into trouble in the first place.
Yeah. Lack of creativity.
Yeah, I guess. Or just at least not having anyone in charge to sort of give them the creative like juice to go, hey, maybe think about this. I don't know.
Yeah.
But as Mumford said, that would have taken at least 5 years just to design the complex mechanism that would actually allow the ride to work, switching the coasters over and over again, much less build the actual ride. Disney needed something sooner, smaller, and better. So at one of these planning meetings between Lucas and the folks at Imagineering, George walks by a few storyboards that are tacked up on a wall somewhere, and they showed first-person views of activities like whitewater rafting and airplane piloting and, you know, whatever. And being the curious type, he asked, well, what are these about? Those storyboards belonged to Randy Bright, an Imagineer from the Disney Film Division, who had just been to London recording some new orchestral elements of Epcot at the famous Abbey Road Studios. And on this trip, he happened to get a tour of Rediffusion Simulation, a company that manufactured ride simulators for airplane pilot training, but they were also trying to break out into the leisure industry. So this company wanted to start a thing.
That's my industry.
I know. Yeah. What do you do? I'm in the leisure industry. Yeah, what do? I support it. I prop it up. Yeah.
Huge supporter of leisure.
I mean, it sounds like they wanted to build a ride simulator where you could go whitewater rafting or, you know.
Oh, okay. Like,
or fly or whatever, right? Like that kind of leisure.
That's cool.
Hot air balloon. Pretend you're a hot air balloon or whatever. Lucas said, hey, that sounds like it could be a cool thing for this ride. And so Tony Baxter and his team flew to London to check out Rediffusion Simulation. And when they get there, they were less than thrilled. The simulator was fairly rudimentary and basic. Airplane seats, like, bolted to plywood, positioned on hydraulics with, like, some walls. That's it. It wasn't a whole lot going on with it. Rediffusion chose a roller coaster as their demonstration video to meet the perceived demands of the Imagineers were asking the simulator to meet. Like, can it do sharp turns? Can it bank at speed? And things like that. The things the system hadn't really done yet, because it's, again, mostly for pilot training.
Okay.
So, you know, you get gentle curves, you know, whatever. Apparently, those maneuvers that the Imagineers were asking to see demonstrated broke the Rediffusion machine in the middle of the demo. But that didn't stop the Imagineers from seeing its potential. They were very excited about possibly using this new tech to tell a story in a totally different way. They saw the potential immediately, even though it was literally seats on plywood and it broke. They still recognized the potential, which I think is sort of what makes a good Imagineer a great Imagineer. That's what makes Tony Baxter great. You can sort of see that stuff. Mm-hmm. And he goes, oh, yes, we can make this work. Let's not worry about it. Baxter and his team loved what they saw. And reports I read mentioned them ordering 4 units at $500,000 a piece. Well, Wikipedia said it. I mean, I don't know how much of that is true, but let's just call it true.
Let me go change it right now. I'm going to make it $1 million.
Wait, hold on. Breaking news. We have breaking news. Something that was originally used to train pilots could now be used to thrill 12-year-old brats. Technology is amazing. But, of course, there were limitations. The simulator itself had a massive 15-foot range of motion, so it could tilt the cabin 15 feet in any direction. Imagine being in Star Tours and that thing shifting like 45 degrees down or back or up. It's huge.
That's a lot more than, yeah.
Right. So Imagineers had to figure out how to tone this down and refine the hydraulics more in order to reduce wear and tear of the system running 365 days a year for 18 hours a day, year after year after year.
Not to mention, like, puke.
Not to mention preventing motion sickness.
Yes.
Because if everyone gets sick on the ride, nobody's going to get on the ride.
Right.
Just going to smell like vomit and sick. So Imagineers had their ride vehicle, again, thanks to George Lucas. If Lucas hadn't seen that, who knows if this would have ever reached their brain capacity, right? So, Lucas, ride vehicle inspiration, check mark.
Now, $1 million.
Now they just needed a way to make the visuals come into play. And this was before videotape was really a thing, and what was on the market didn't really look as good as film did, so film it was. Disney mounted a massive 70-millimeter film projector on the front of the ride car and a film looping box in the back to house the actual film stock. Now, 70-millimeter film is what you go to see in the movie theaters.
Okay.
So if you ever see a movie that is like gets meta and shows you a movie projector, it's like the big, huge thing. These things are massive. They're huge. So the film looping box was in the back to house the actual film stock, and then it ran through to the projector. And a short note, our friend Ub Iwerks invented this loop box as a way to keep film running on a continuous loop, hence the name, without touching itself, which would eliminate scratches and keeping the film as clean than if it were to be wound over itself like normal. Like when you spool up a roll of film, it just the film's touching itself.
Yeah.
Over and over and over again, scratches, it wears out, needs to be replaced. But this way, it's perfect.
Yeah.
It's clean.
Okay.
Pretty cool. But all this added weight to the system, further complicating the hydraulics and choreographed movements Disney would have to account for. Now, here's Lucas talking about what makes this cool ride system so cool.
One of the basic ideas behind this is that it's reprogrammable. It relies a lot on software rather than hardware, so that the ride can be changed rather swiftly, relative to the way normal rail rides, hardware rides are, you know, changed. And I think this will give us a big advantage in being able to upgrade the ride after, you know, a certain period of time to you know, improve it or change it or, you know, make it into something else.
He's not a very personable guy, is he?
Wake up, George. No, he's not. But he's right, because you have the film on the ride, basically, mounted there. The ride doesn't move anywhere. There's no track. If you ever want to change it, you just shoot a new sequence of whatever it's going to be. They haven't figured that out yet. And you plug it into the ride, and then the thing is there again. You don't have to mount track and move it and cut it and weld it and do new sets and do new whatever. It just lives in the ride. You can just change it. It's very modular that way.
It's very smart.
Yeah.
And I like that he's actually like thinking about the future of the ride. Like at some point, you're going to want this to be something different.
That's right.
So that's kind of cool.
After several attempts at trying out a storyline for the new ride, Disney settled on it being a tour company that would take guests on scenic tours of Star Wars locations. Now, the original name of the tour company was going to be Cosmic Winds. And the ride was going to have sort of like a comedic feel to it, like a haphazard, you know, like a jokey sort of a thing.
There are so many fart jokes.
Yeah. But that later changed to Star Tours Travel Agency, I think is what it is now. Which, thankfully, I mean, Cosmic Winds, get out of here. But it's also very, like, I don't know, late 70s, early 80s, like...
It's very Eisner. I'm actually surprised it didn't go through.
Now, I thought that the Star Wars name was just licensed to Disney and that Imagineers did all the visuals and they were responsible for all the film and whatnot. And I was really wrong, and I'm sort of happy about that, honestly. It was the masters at ILM, Industrial Light and Magic, which is a place I'm still trying to tunnel my way into. I'm almost there. I have a couple more 100 yards to go, and I'm a breakthrough.
More spoonfuls.
Yes, that's right. I eat the dirt. That's why I'm an earthworm. That's why it's taken me so long. Anyway, ILM was behind the effects and the entire filming of the ride sequence, actually. And hearing Tony Baxter talk about what the ride is, this sort of makes sense, right? The ride is a fixed point in time, the present. It's not showing you the past or the future. Your screen in front of you is a window. You can't look away or change scenes like you can say on like Mr. Toad or Alice, where you know, fade to black and the next scene starts or whatever. It's all real time as it happens actions. So the effects gurus at ILM were the perfect folks to film this giant ride experience and hide the scene transitions perfectly. Not to mention you couldn't film every sequence in the same roll of film over months and months of shooting. So something had to be done to disguise the fact and make things feel seamless. You see what I mean? Like, you're on Star Tours, you're in a car. It's like you're driving in a car, you're filming your trip to the store. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't just suddenly be at one light and then going the next second. You have to film the whole journey. How do you do that? You have to hide your cuts in some of the effects, some of the flashes, hide cuts and whatever, right? Does the TIE fighter battle and all this kind of stuff. Explosions. At one point, a meteor comes through. They hide a cut there. So they can do a shot and make it look seamless, but obviously it takes... Well, work on the film took a year and a half.
Wow.
So what are you going to do? Have a 4-minute roll of film in your camera, like shooting? No, it's not going to happen.
Yeah.
It took a year and a half, taking up just 4.5 minutes of total film.
That's
when
insane.
Done.
You know, I wish there are some great ways to do that. And I like your particular examples there, but it just makes me think of Soarin', where we've got an elephant that throws some dirt up in the air and suddenly you're in another part of the world.
Yep.
And then a whale jumps.
Yeah. It's true. What? Yeah. It's very weird, man. Now, all of these ideas had to be ran past George Lucas so he could reject things or give ideas on how to improve. And he did contribute quite a lot. It was Lucas's idea to have a pilot in the ride car with you as a physical robot rather than a projection on a screen. Now, this was to be a robot that had never been in the Star Wars films before. A totally new piece of lore. Creating something so new and dumping it into a franchise that has produced millions of rabid, insane fans all around the world would be a daunting task for anyone. Right, Rob? I mean, come on.
Yes.
Can you imagine if you had to go like, hey, well, Rob, you need to come up, invent our new robot for Star Wars fans that won't get you doxxed and like your house burnt down.
Right. The only good thing is it was in the late 70s and early 80s, so there wasn't this thing called social media to tear you apart. apart immediately and tell you how much of an idiot you are for doing it. So
I guess
that was really saving grace right there.
I guess the worst thing that could have happened was like someone would have taken an ad out in the local paper commentary on the new robot. I don't think this is what anyway. Yeah, right. But Imagineers knew they really, really, really had to get this right. So they had to make it cute and likable right off the jump. And I love stories like this, like the why things happen. The sort of why I fell in love with Disneyland and why I wanted to do this podcast in the first place. Why? You have a robot, you want it to be cute so people like it. Okay, but why? What did you do? How did you do that? So the new robot would be called RX-24, or Rex for short. And the story would be that it was his first day at the company. His first flight, even, and he was nervous. There would be mistakes, lots of them. Oh, and screaming. That was an element they wanted in Rex's personality, too. Specifically, lots of screaming.
Okay.
The voice of Pee-wee Herman, Paul Rubens, was the perfect fit. And in case you've forgotten what Rex screaming sounds like,
oh dear,
here's a little clip.
I knew that it was Paul Rubens.
Yeah.
But I never really put two and two together that it was like it never like hit me until just now. And I absolutely love that.
Yeah.
And also I just realized that I went on Star Tours before I had ever seen Star Wars.
There you go.
Anything Star Wars.
Look at that. Paul Rubens also happened to be the voice of the UFO in a movie called Flight of the Navigator, which had just been released by Disney. So they had his number. And in that movie, if you watch the credits, he's credited as Paul Mall in that for some reason. I don't know. But apparently the story behind it is they were looking for a voice. They wanted Paul Rubens. They thought it'd be perfect. And they called him on the set of Pee-wee's Playhouse while he's doing that. And, you know, they were like, well, he's not really that famous yet. You know what I mean? So they could just sort of get a hold of him. And he said, yeah, totally. I'll just totally do that.
That's anyway, awesome.
The voice of Captain Rex originally was described by George Lucas as a frazzled Clone Wars veteran called Crazy Harry. So maybe that's why he couldn't do so well at the flying, but I think Imagineers maybe toned it back and made it silly. Who knows? But I thought that was a pretty cool piece of lore. Crazy Harry was almost his name. The motions of the ride were programmed with a joystick, manipulating the ride car to pitch and drop and thrust to the cues of the film, and then that programming was then translated digitally to the ride controls. At the same time Star Tours was in production, a little attraction by the name of Captain EO was also being put together. Mm-hmm. While Lucas had signed on to oversee the project of Captain EO while still busy with Star Tours, he gave directing duties to Francis Ford Coppola. Apparently Coppola really needed a job. It was like sort of sad, but he was like his mentor. So he's like, okay, here, I'll give back to the boss guy and, you know, whatever. That way he could still be involved with Star Tours. Now, EO is only tangentially relevant, but I like EO, so we're going to hear a little bit about it. The production of EO was a monstrosity, and it ate away at its original budget of $17 million very, very quickly, coming in at about $22 million. So much attention was on EO getting finished without bleeding any more money, and the bigwigs at Disney left the Star Tours kids alone just to plod along. I mean, they were on budget, they were doing just fine, they were meeting all their deadlines. Why rock the boat? They were doing so well, in fact, that despite being greenlit before Captain EO, Star Tours was completed first, before Captain EO. That's how delayed it was, which might not make a whole lot of sense, but if you think about it, Captain EO was a movie. It was a complicated movie, but it was a movie. There was no ride to sort out, no problems of how to do the things to finish it, no programming of anything, no problems like that to solve. So EO really should have finished before Star Tours by all accounts, but like I said, that production was weird. I think Terrence did the history of Captain EO already, so you can go back and listen to one of those shows. And a lot of stuff went on with it. That's Hollywood for you. Despite Star Tours being show ready, Disney wanted EO to open first, which it did on September 18th, 1986, and it pushed back the opening of Star Tours until the next year, giving the team even more time to dial in the hydraulic effects and make things as smooth as possible. Now, Eisner really wanted to push the fact that Disney had more content coming to its parks, and they really weren't just letting things go. This was his moment to right the ship, as it were. So they made a teaser special showcasing Star Tours. On December 28th, 1986, George Lucas's Star Tours aired as part of the Disney Sunday Night Movie on ABC. And in case you forgot how cool the Disney Sunday Night Movie on ABC theme music is, or theme music was, here it is for you. I cut it out. It's thoroughly 80s. Don't worry, it gets 80s. Yeah. Thank you for indulging me. I loved it.
I sort of love it too.
It's really great. I love it. All right.
My windbreaker when I was listening.
Yeah. Oh, it's by the cardboard square that you use to break dance with. It's over there.
Yeah. That's right.
All right. Now here's how the 18 minute special opened. This is the opening Disney Sunday Night Movie, ABC. This played before whatever the movie was. I should have put it in my notes, but I didn't because it's irrelevant. But this is how it opened. Someone thought this was a good idea, and I, for one, agree.
The following message is brought to you by the Intergalactic Bureau of Tourism.
How humiliating. I am fluent in over 6 million forms of communication, and here I am doing commercials for outer space. Oh, well. Hit it, R2. C-3PO, rapping about space, the new place to go. You can eat all you want and you won't gain a pound because there isn't any weight here like back on the ground. We travel very fast near the speed of light. You can leave in the morning and get home last night. His name is R2, but you'll never hear him rap. His inventor forgot to give him lips that flap. He'll greet you all and turn on his charms. He'd give you a hug if he had some arms. There's no gravity when you're out in space. It doesn't pull you down or hold you in place. You can run real fast, your feet will fly. You'll be so light, you can jump sky high. New worlds open up when you're out that far, and all you've got to do is wish upon a star.
That might be the best thing that has ever come out of the Star Wars universe.
Was that actually Anthony Daniels?
Yes.
It sounded like.
Yeah.
It sounded like Revenge of the Nerds when they did the
Lamar. With little old BC-3PO.
Yep. Oh, my goodness. And by the way, it was Tiger Town was the movie that was coming in after that 18
okay.
minute.
Awesome. There you go. Tiger Town. Everyone remembers that.
Everyone remembers that movie. Sure do.
So the special starred Gil Gerard, who played Buck Rogers on the Buck Rogers TV show, and Ernie Reyes, who was starring in the ABC sitcom Sidekicks at the time. Basically, they just waxed poetic about space travel, but it was sort of cool. It was from the standpoint of, hey, Star Tours is real. Hey, these, so they were in like the ride queue, right? And they're like, hey, these droids in the queue are really working on space stuff. And isn't that be cool? I can't wait to go into space. It's cute. And there's some funny lines in it. The best part is Ernie Reyes getting ready to board the ride in like a little fantasy sequence. In it, you see Reyes suiting up and Gerard addresses him like a military general. It's a little long, but there's a payoff at the end of it. Oh, hang on a second.
Attention, astronauts. I'm your squadron commander. You have been selected for this mission on Star Speeder 3000 because you're tough, brave, clean and mean, and ready to face any danger you might encounter in space. Your Star Speeder weighs over 20,000 pounds. Bringing it to the launch site at Disneyland meant shutting down freeways, rerouting traffic, sealing off highways. Maneuvering a 10-ton payload into position took every man we had. Construction went on around the clock. All leave were canceled. C-3PO took command of the Earthlings on the project. Droids never sleep. You men can learn a lesson from that. The onboard computers were checked, double-checked, and checked again. George Lucas ran the last-minute inspections. A final check was made of the hyperspeed mechanism. Gentlemen, you've been trained by the best. You're as ready as you'll ever be for space travel. Now get out there and conquer it. Hey, kid. Take a snack in case you get hungry up there. May the Force be with you. And never let me say that on Buck Rogers.
It's cute, but they actually spit some actual facts. The ride cars are 20,000 pounds, and they shut that. I thought it was interesting.
It made it kind of sound scary, though. Like that's not actually what the ride is.
Here's like suiting up. He has a flight suit, and at the end it says like, you do not actually have flight suits. This is part of the fantasy, but that's how it is. they shot it as like, this is his fantasy. This is Reyes' fantasy about like suiting up and flying to space. And it's a thing. Yeah. But it's a cool little thing. I suggest you guys go look it up. It's pretty neat. I was surprised because Disney actually showed parts of the ride show in the little clip. Like he goes in, he's buckled in the Star Speeder, and you see scenes from the ride. Like he's flying on the ride and you see actual scenes about what's going on. So you get a really good taste for what the ride will be as a viewer. And I think this would hype it up anybody to go to the park, Star Wars fan or not. It's cute. It's a cute thing.
Well, it's a new type of ride. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
And I like when he told the kids to take a snack up there. Can you imagine trying to eat a snack while on the ride? You're like, all over.
Yeah, it's like the scene in Airplane. Star Tours was housed in the Adventures Through Inner Space building. The People Mover was still running through it at this time, RIP. So folks riding that could look down on the Star Tour speeder at the entrance, circle behind C-3PO, and lightly zoom off to wherever it is the thing went next. The ride queue is pretty much the same as it was for Inner Space, as I talked about on our History of Adventures Through Inner Space show. On display was a replica, a life-size replica, of the Star Speeder 3000 with R2-D2 on top doing some welding, and C-3PO's over to his left harassing him as usual. When you enter the building and you see R2 and 3PO there greeting you, it's sort of meant to anchor you to let you know that this is a Star Wars themed ride. It's not just an old space rocket blast off kind of thing with Star Wars plaster and thing. Like you're in the Star Wars universe.
Okay.
There's a rumor on the internet that the 3PO and R2 suits or whatever used for this part of the queue were props from the original Star Wars film, but I can't really prove that. But I don't know. We'll just say maybe. But at any rate, it doesn't really matter because they've long since been replaced. So whatever, it doesn't really matter.
Aegon.
In order to program the 3PO animatronic, Anthony Daniels, the actor who plays 3PO in the movies and basically literally everywhere else, like in voice and, you know, in that suit, produced some reference footage specifically for Disney animators to help them get the motions right. Disney Imagineers knew that they had to really nail the look and the feel and the sound of 3PO. He's a major part of Star Wars. Getting his movements wrong would just sort of be a disservice to what's going on, but I think also throw people out of the vibe. At the time, the 3PO animatronic would be running longer than any other animated figure Disney had ever done up to that point. And back then, animations were done using a special digital console, and the movements were recorded on magnetic tape. That tape was then transferred to a magnetic disc for use in the, quote, show control unit. That disc is then connected to a digital analog converter, and stuff moves around. I don't know. It's a whole show maybe on the technology. It only matters really to clarify this cool fact that at the time, animations were described in feet of animation, meaning feet of magnetic tape used to encode the animation. So a figure from Pirates at the time took about 90 feet of animation. So you think about the last time you were on Pirates, the guy, I don't know, playing the, you know, sousaphone or whatever. Sousaphone. He's just, you know, doing the squeeze box back and forth, and he rotates and, like, you know, his mouth moves a bit. That's kind of it, right? 90 feet, tape feet of animation. Pretty limited.
I'm worried about your definition of sousaphone.
What's the concertina? That's the word I'm looking for.
There we go.
Concertina my phone. Whatever. Mr. Lincoln, on the other hand, 400 feet of animation. Mm. Okay? which makes sense. He does a lot more. He sits there and he blinks and he stands up and he gesticulates, right? 3PO at the time, 900 feet of animation with 22 moves that he can pull off in total. And that's a lot of pirates.
Yes.
Pretty neat. I mean, he was very, very, very animated at the time. I mean, still
did,
was, I guess.
How long was that loop? Do you know that? Like,
I don't. I mean, it's 900 feet of tape, and then they translated it to the disc, like, to actually, like, move it. So, yeah, I mean, 900 feet.
It's 900 feet. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah. Moving along in the queue past the Starspeeder 3000, guests are shuffled through the droid maintenance hangar, watching a G2 droid conducting repairs on other droids, but being distracted by the guests filing by. Now, the droid skeletons, I think we've mentioned this a few times on whatever shows he's come up with. The droid skeletons were reused geese from America Sings, hence the G in the G2 name. Clever.
Okay.
Geese. Here's Imagineer Tom Fitzgerald describing the reasoning behind the Q design. Clip one, Jason.
You'll also, in this area, see some travelogues from Star Tours saying, you know, coming up service to Hoth and Dagobah and Tatooine, but saying that now they have nonstop service to Endor, and that's where we're going today. But before we get there, we pass through what's called the Droid Gnostic Center. And here, Star Tours is so proud of the care and precision with which their pilots are assembled that instead of hiding it off back, where we usually have maintenance operations, they put it on display. And they have what we call our G2 droids, who are repairing navigators and getting them ready for your flight. But unfortunately, the G2 droids are kind of goof-offs. And the little one, the laborer droid, who's welding, or supposed to be welding, gets very distracted by the guests and starts asking them how to fix the droids and where they're going and hasn't he seen them before. And the other droid is sort of monitoring the activities of the room. From there, we enter the loading concourse, and you're sent to one of four gates to board the Starspeeder. And then you're off on your adventure with your rookie pilot, Rex.
It's kind of neat to hear the thinking behind why we're going through the workstations of these droids while we're going on vacation. I mean, would you feel good about boarding an airplane and seeing how they assemble the engines? I wouldn't.
Yeah, no.
But I've also never really thought about why. Like, why are they shuffling us through the maintenance corridor? Why isn't this like a fancy pilot lounge or something?
How about, you know, wondering why they're fixing the engine, but then also the fact that the one guy who's supposed to be fixing it is not really paying attention.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, he's like clowning on you. He's like, look at this kid. Now, once you get to the ride vehicle, your experiences are meant to mirror boarding an airplane. You take your seats, you stow your luggage, you watch the safety video, etc. And once on board, your brand new pilot Rex would take you on your adventure to the forest moon of Endor. However, things go off the rails from the get-go. No pun intended, because this isn't a ride that has rails. diving into a maintenance yard, avoiding collisions, and we're out of the hangar and into open space. Rex tells R2, who's our co-pilot or navigator, right, to make the jump to light speed, but we actually jump past Endor and into a comet cluster. Which sounds like a candy bar, honestly.
Oh, that would be delicious.
Weaving and crashing about, we clear that danger and end up running into an Imperial Star Destroyer. The Starspeeder gets caught in a tractor beam and gets pulled up, 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 and all seems lost. But an intrepid X-Wing fighter, in a world where intrepid X-Wing fighters swoop in to save the day and free us. But we aren't out of the woods yet, friends. In fact, now we have joined the Resistance and are accompanying the Rebels in attacking what looks to be like a third Death Star. Rex destroys some TIE fighters and provides cover for the Rebels to destroy this Death Star, just like the first one, and similarly maybe like the second one, but more like the first one, with a double shot of proton torpedoes right up the exhaust port. And you'd think by the third Death Star they'd sort of sorted that problem out.
Changed the plan.
Yeah. Anyway, the Death Star explodes and we
punch it
back to the hangar and nearly collide with the fuel truck and kill ourselves. C'est la vie. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to come back. We're going to talk about opening day. So hang on, everybody. It's his ears up. We'll be right back. Gee, sorry, guys, but that guy bought 14 churros. I'm all sold out.
And now back to the show.
All right, thanks for hanging on, everybody. All right, we're going to talk about opening day for Star Tours now. That's the setup. Figured out, you know, basically, roughly, how it came to be, how it came to existence. But now we're going to be at the birth, basically.
Okay, here we go.
This is the actual display of Star Tours. Opening day for this breakthrough attraction was January 9th, 1987. We're already set for the massive crowds that stretched back all the way to the front gates. On a stage built for the event, a show like no other was about to be performed. A huge symbol took up the bulk of the stage, ironically looking a lot like the Star Trek symbol, like a big stylized arrowhead. With much fanfare, that lowered into a kind of catwalk, and then the characters of Han, Luke, Leia, and Agrippa Ewoks took the stage. Of course, Vader shows up like he always does, and a fierce battle takes place. And I use the term fierce in like the RuPaul meeting, because this really wasn't just a battle, it was a severely choreographed dance sequence. Over-exaggerated actions, dramatic lunges, and when Vader is defeated, spontaneous ballet breaks out. Very, very 80s, and very, very weird. After the stage clears, the Cantina Band comes out with X-Wing fighter pilots, other bounty hunters, basically recreating the Cantina scene as best as you can from the original Star Wars. Everyone has cool-looking drinking glasses. I mean, it looks like just spare parts attached in this big long cylinder, and everyone's having a good time. Smoke is billowing out of every cup, you know, dry ice or whatever. 3PO and R2 roll out and introduce Eisner and Lucas. Eisner welcomes several astronauts and Imagineers who worked on the ride. All of our characters from the dance sequence come out, and Luke and Han unfurl this long ribbon. 3PO asks R2 for the scissors to cut the ribbon, and in true form, R2 just doesn't have them. But don't worry, guys. Space Mickey and Space Minnie run in to save the day with an air quote lightsaber, which is really like a long metal rod with a big electrical cord running out the back. Anyway, Eisner and Lucas together touch the thing to a special place on the ribbon. It sparks, breaks the ribbon apart, the ribbon's cut, confetti flies, and we're finally at the back end of this hellscape. Now, wow. If you remember, Walt's take on Tomorrowland was that it was to be science factual, a far cry from what it is today. So next time someone trots out some old clip or quote of Walt asking, "What would Walt do?" remember this. Because what Walt might have wanted and what the public wants are sometimes at odds with one another. Star Tours was such an instant success that Disneyland was kept open for 60 hours straight.
Wow.
Just to squash the lines. From January 9th at 10 a.m. to January 11th at 10 p.m., that line never stopped moving. The gates never closed.
Wow.
Yeah. This was also the case when Captain EO opened, by the way. Just fact.
Okay.
At a total cost of about $32 million, almost twice what it would have cost to build Disneyland itself back in 1955, Star Tours was a certified hit. The ride hit the same in each of the Disney theme parks it opened at, of course also giving George Lucas $1 million a year,
yeah,
spawning a deep fandom and a rediscovery of that special generational love of the original Star Wars films. Oh, plus merch. You can't forget merch. There was tons of merch. Now, this is a new word I learned. The canonicity of the events depicted in Star Tours has been disputed for many reasons, the most obvious being the inclusion of the Death Star. Since R2-D2's presence aboard the Star Speeder precludes the events taking place during the Battle of Yavin, this is going to get really nerdy, so but basically I'm just talking to you, Rob, or the Battle of Endor. I mean, not to disparage Eric's breadth of Star Wars knowledge, but whatever. The Death Star seen in the ride video has been considered by some to be the Death Star prototype, as seen in Jedi Search and Champions of the Force, and its destruction to be a depiction of the prototype's destruction at the Maw. However, it does not match that prototype's skeletal construction, and R2-D2 was accounted for during that event, so therefore it could not happen. Also, the Star Tours Death Star is close to Endor, far from the Maw's location. This may indicate that it's a so far unrevealed Death Star, or that the ride's events are simply not canonical. Leland Chi, in a timeline he created, implied that the first possibility was true. Others have suggested that the Death Star is a modification of one of the habitation spheres seen under construction over Coruscant. This was later confirmed in the Supreme Commander Enix Devon's entry for the second part of the blog series, The Imperial Warlords. The spoilers of an empire. You got to get in the weeds a little bit, because a lot of people do sort of complain about the timeline of the movies compared to Star Tours. Like, it just sort of steps on itself just immediately. And that doesn't go away with the refresh either. It just continues to, whatever. The events of Star Tours may take place after Star Wars Episode 5, The Empire Strikes Back, since after the destination of Hoth is advertised on the large video screen in the queue, C-3PO mentions the events of the film. So it takes place after that. In 2005, Lucasfilm's Leland Chee again tentatively dated the events of the ride at 4.3 ABY. Rob, what does that mean?
After the Battle of Yavin, which was when Darth Vader was defeated.
There you go. This was later confirmed in the 2013 blog Covenant Daily Departures, The History of Star Tours, which also explained R2-D2 and C-3PO's presence at Star Tours being loaned to the company by their owners during the latter stages of the Nagai Toph War, which I'm sure everyone is very familiar with.
Definitely. It's my favorite war.
As with all material released prior to April 25th, 2014, questions of canonicity regarding Star Tours apply only to the continuity of the expanded universe, now known as Star Wars Legends, and its story is considered entirely non-canon within the current continuity of canon. I stole this content from Wikipedia. I have no idea what it means. I think someone out there will.
So, Eric, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but once Disney took over, they said all this other stuff that people wrote about Star Wars no longer exists. We're only going with this small section here. And that's what became canon versus legends. Legends is what all the extra books and comic books and all that stuff are all in that. So they're saying since this has the third Death Star and all that stuff, that it's not part of Disney's canon knowledge, and it's just almost like fan fiction-ish type of other, goes in the other category.
Very true. And what I've heard also about the design of Star Tours, the Imagineers were so focused on, well, George Lucas is so focused on getting his canon and keeping things within that overall story, they were trying to construct a story that would work within a specific timeline, but still give people the thrills that they wanted. And then George Lucas said, "You know what? The people want to go to Hoth." Wait, do I have to do the voice? Well, the people want to go to Hoth. And, you know, he just basically said, "This is a ride. Let's do something fun," and they can go to all the places that they saw in the movies and
they can do
blow up the Death Star.
Yeah.
Just do it.
After a few years, the excitement wore off, and while the ride was still very popular, people already knew what to expect. The ride, originally thought of to be modular and changeable, as Lucas was saying in that clip we played, stayed the same for over a decade. The thought was literally, at Imagineering, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. Things were running so well, why would Disney muck about?
Yeah.
Well, 12 years on, in 1999, the Star Wars universe got some new additions. I would normally say it received a refresh, but the fan in me just can't accept that Star Wars Episode I hitting the theaters as a refresh. But it did, and Disney saw this as the perfect way to plus up its Star Tours ride, with new experiences for a brand new audience. But the problem with that is they found out there was also going to be an Episode 2 and 3. So once they found out there were going to be 3 movies in total added to the franchise, they thought, well, let's just wait and see what unfolds here before we go adding anything, you know? They wanted to make sure that they picked the really definitive locations and characters of these films to be in the ride before taking the costly steps to add them in. It's almost like, you done? Yeah. Can we play now? We're done? You're done? Okay, we're done. All right, let's go. New content was pulled in from the prequel films, including Darth Vader, Boba Fett, Imperial Stormtroopers, the Jump Troopers, Admiral Akbar, Yoda, Princess Leia, and Chewbacca. I always say Chewbacca. I don't know why. I love it. Destinations now included Tatooine, Coruscant, Hoth, Naboo, Kashyyyk, and the Death Star as it orbits Geonosis. During pre-production, one of the locations that the Imagineers wanted guests to visit was the ice planet of Hoth, while it was under siege by Imperial walkers. However, that idea was quickly scrapped because it would interfere with the attraction's placement in the Star Wars timeline, but it was already sort of like blown out of proportion anyway.
So why did it matter?
So who cares, right? According to Imagineer Jason Sorrell, after the Hoth battle idea was replaced with an encounter with the planet's native creatures like Tauntauns and Wampas, the concept was then presented to Lucas. He liked the idea of the replacements, but he requested that the battle scene being used anyways, even if it meant disrupting the series canon. Lucas is just like, I don't care if it makes the story impossible to follow along. Nobody matters. Nobody cares.
Yeah.
He offered the possibility that there was perhaps an earlier scuffle between the Rebel and Imperial forces on the planet before the events of Episode 5 unfolded, that they later decided to build a base there, figuring the Empire wouldn't think the Rebels would return to that same location. So again, there's Lucas. Here's an idea, guys. Here's how else you can say, if you want Hoth, I agree. Let's do Hoth, but do it with a battle Hoth. How do we figure out the timeline, George? I don't know, man. They were here first. Who cares? 100,001, 100,002, 100,003. You know what I mean? Gives.
Well, they gave him the good bills.
Yeah. Wow. Well, you know, why not? The Kashyyyk sequence, sorry, Rob, I didn't mean to offend you, was suggested by none other than John Lasseter.
Ah, Gropey McGroper.
So you start off with Vader, and then you jump to light speed, and from here you can end up on Tatooine or Hoth, and you bail from there, and you jump to light speed again, and you have yet another set of locations you could end up on. This way, Imagineers were able to kind of satisfy all Star Wars nerds and their thirst for content by producing these other destinations for them while still keeping the story cohesive. Ish. More than 54 different story combinations were here in the original refresh, even though it always seemed to give me the same like six scenes every time I wrote it.
Same thing. I mean, I don't go as often as, you know, Eric does, but when I did, I feel like I rode the same ride. They're like, oh, no, every time you go, it's different. I'm like, really? I remember the scene.
That's what I remember, too, where we first heard that. I was like, no, it's not. You're pulling my leg, dude. Get out of here. No, it's different. Like, okay. I'm the cooler, okay. Apparently. Yeah, because it's definitely, yeah. Definitely not.
Definitely not, yeah.
This was also the right time to replace the old 70mm film projector and loop box still in use since 1987, and the ride cars were converted to allow for this new format, freeing up valuable weight and space limitations to make an overall better, smoother ride experience. The ride cars were also renamed as Starspeeder 1000s, because they were going to be involved in the Star Wars prequels. So by default, these new ships had to actually be older.
Oh my God, my brain hurts.
Yeah. For the refresh, Imagineers went back to change what already had worked by getting rid of Rex and developing a brand new pilot for the ride vehicle. This new pilot would be a cocky ace pilot who would be sure to deliver the guests back at the spaceport with little to no trouble. Lucas kept saying, no, we need to stick with nervous and not very good. Ace would just not be as exciting of a plot device. And of course, he was right. Now, after the refresh, the ride would start with Ace in the pilot seat, and he's quickly replaced by C-3PO making some final checks and whatever, and he ends up stuck flying the ship. So, another one for Lucas. He knew how to drive the story.
He died.
Lucas had to give his blessing on the final product, which he did, but he also had some suggestions. Now, not all of Lucas's suggestions were used or probably any good. For example, there was one point, I'm imagining when they go to Naboo and they go underwater, he wanted to have water spray at the crowd.
Oh, okay.
So the thing was leaking?
Basically, yeah. And they're like, nah, dog. I mean, you have water in an enclosed environment.
Yeah.
Year after year, it's not a good look, dude.
No.
Another idea he had was to have a part of the plot being that the Empire is looking for a rebel spy.
Oh, so that's
on
new?
Your boat. It's part of the refresh. Yeah.
Oh, I didn't
and the spy
that.
Would be on board your ride. What's more, it was his idea that a camera would be inside to take a picture of a random guest on the ride and make them the spy. And to me, this became one of the better additions to Star Tours and perhaps the most iconic, really.
Definitely.
I mean, once you get over the ride, it's like the rebel spy. Everyone wants to be the rebel spy. It sort of bonds you to the ride a little bit more. Like, oh, I could be the thing, right?
Yeah.
And then you buy the shirt.
And you buy the shirt.
I didn't know there was a shirt. I would have bought the shirt.
Yeah, there were always shirts that in the shop right on the way.
Really?
You're heading down the ramp, and right in the front of you was usually a shirt that read, I was the rebel spy.
Oh.
Were you the rebel spy?
I was the rebel spy once. It was awesome.
That's cool. See, there you go. You can thank George Lucas for that.
I, like, didn't recognize myself. My sister was like, that's you. And I was like, oh, because it's, like, the blurriest photo in the entire world.
Well, and you were probably going, meh.
Yeah, exactly.
Two eyes half open. the ride queue got an overhaul as well, but, you know, still had some good Easter eggs in it. Some good homages to other Disney IP and whatever. In the ride queue, after one of the G2 units, which is named G29T, apparently, somehow starts causing alarms to go off and gets a call from his supervisor. The droid at one point says, everything's perfectly all right now. We're fine. We're all fine here now. Thank you. How are you? Just a paraphrase of what Han Solo said while trying to maintain cover after killing most of the security detail for the detention block AA-23 in A New Hope. He also says, boring conversation anyway, after cutting off his supervisor mid-sentence, which is also from the same scene. One of the items being scanned in the luggage by G29T was a Goofy doll, prompting him to say that the design was really goofy. These are quality jokes, people. When finding a Goofy hat in another luggage set, G29T will mistake it for a Jar Jar Binks-style hat. A Chippendale doll seen in a scanned luggage has G29T calling them clones. Upon discovering the magic lamp from Aladdin, he mentions that the Star Tour's non-smoking policy extends to luggage as well. Wall-E from the Pixar film of the same name can also be seen in one of the scans, attempting to get G29T's attention. He fails to see this and clears the suitcase without knowing. Other luggage cameos include Madame Leota from the Haunted Mansion, a Stitch plush, Sorcerer Mickey's hat from Fantasia, Mike Wazowski's teddy bear from Monsters, Inc., Indiana Jones's hat and whip, the Mighty Microscope and Snowflake from Adventures Through Inner Space, and Vincent from The Black Hole, which I think is what Rob was maybe talking about, the floating robot. At one point, the announcer calls out for an illegally parked speeder with license number THX-1138, which is the name of the first studio film made by George Lucas. The announcer pages a Mr. Egrogig Sackle, which is the name of George Lucas spelled backwards. A voice says there's a message for Mr. Tom Morrow, who was a character in Disneyland's now-defunct Flight to the Moon attraction and later became a separate character for Innoventions at Epcot and Disney Park in 1998. In the queue, you can see a model of Kermit the Frog made from spare parts when you get to the overhead conveyor belt, the baskets of parts in the Droidnostic Center, and the ride queue at Disneyland and Hollywood Studios have hidden initials and birth dates of Walt Disney Imagineering and ILM team members who worked on the attraction. When Energizer sponsored the Disney Hollywood Studios version, the Energizer Bunny made a cameo appearance in the shop on a video screen. On the pre-boarding video, many passengers are Imagineers and their families. The woman sitting next to Teak in the pre-show, Teak was Ewok, in the pre-show video, she's wearing a cast member costume for Epcot Computer Central, which is an attraction formerly located in Epcot's Communicore Pavilion. The exit of the Tokyo Disneyland version features a Toroscan kiosk that uses the footage from the multiple endings of the discontinued Epcot attractions Horizons to portray other Star Wars or other Star Tours excursions. The sets for the endings of the footage and by extension the locales featured at the exit were developed by David Jones, who also did special effects work for Star Wars A New Hope. One of the droids, DLX-2, was a modified version of an Imagineer-developed prop for the robot TK-4600 from the NBC police drama series Hill Street Blues. Go figure that one out. On Captain Rex, a bright red tag can be seen attached to his torso. The tag says, "Remove before flight," which is in reference to similar labels placed on some aircraft parts. And Rex had a... This is not part of the refresh, obviously. But Rex had a very bad feeling about this. When a ship flies into one of the comets, it's just a running line to say in the Star Wars films. The fuel tanker in the beginning of the original, then the Starspeeder 3000 almost runs into, the tanker that almost runs into, has a registration number on its side, which apparently is Lucasfilm's old office phone number.
Wow.
I don't know. One of the droids in the queue now says, "You got a camera. Why don't you take a picture? It'll last longer," which is a Paul Rubens quote.
Okay.
It wasn't until 2010 that Disney would be ready to make this switch from Star Tours to the brand new refreshed Star Tours. On July 27th, 2010, Star Tours closed down after 23 years of operating trips towards Endor. Tokyo closed theirs a day earlier on the 26th, and Disney World did so in August, but Disneyland Paris held on tighter than Luke clinging to that antenna underneath Cloud City and didn't close their version of Star Tours until March 16th, 2016, meaning the original version of Star Tours was running somewhere in the world for just about 30 years. That's over $30 million paid to George Lucas.
I know, that's all I'm thinking is I'm like, wow.
Now, the Disney World closing was a whole affair. They did it right, honestly. On August 14th, 2010, in Hollywood Studios, a ticketed event called The Last Tour to Endor kicked off, 8 p.m. to 1 a.m. Entertainment featured and events at Last Tour to Endor included George Lucas, character appearances, Jedi Training Academy, Death Star Disco, Sounds fun as hell. Yeah. Bespin stage dance party, fireworks, and the Star Tours shutdown ceremony, which was a live show with C-3PO, R2-D2, Boba Fett, Darth Vader, and a few stormtroopers, culminating in the official powering down of the original Disney Star Tours attraction. However, instead of R2-D2 simply shutting it down, Boba Fett destroys the ride's power supply using a thermal detonator. It was pretty amazing and probably the coolest send-off to a ride that I've ever seen. It's like there's a stage in front of the show building, and they do this like time thing. I sort of forget now. Someone has video of it on YouTube. And there's like a big fireworks sort of made explosion in the back, and the lights go down and whatever. And it's just, I don't know, man. It was done really, really well. It was timed well. It was designed perfectly. It looked great. It was a great idea. The ride was still open after the shutdown ceremony. It was still open until September 7th, 2010, when the attraction held its final flight to Endor. Not the last one, the final one. The other one was last. This is final. Which was exclusive to D23 members. Star Tours was now known as Star Tours: The Adventures Continue. It officially opened at Florida on May 20th, 2011, in California on June 3rd of the same year, and on Tokyo on May 17th, 2013, and then at Paris, March 18th, 2017. So there's $4 million for you.
Yep.
For Lucas, right there.
In 1 year.
Over a couple years, but still. In 2018, he had $4 million. That's absolutely true. As more Star Wars movies were added, more scenes were added as well, along with characters like Rey and Kylo Ren, bringing the combinations of ride and scene experiences to 384 potential ride combinations. Of course, this had the added complication of skewing the Star Wars timelines and led to much debate in circles that care about this sort of thing. For example, you could have Poe Dameron in one scene on Star Tours and Darth Vader in the next, even though Vader was long dead by the time Poe was even introduced into the movies. But that didn't seem to matter as much to most people as it did to diehard fans. Go figure.
Huh. Yeah. I don't know. Rob, would you have been offended to see Darth Vader and Poe Dameron in close proximity?
It's a ride that I want to ride on, so no. I don't care.
I would have noticed. I would have been like, what are we doing here? But, you know, it still would have been fun. At the 2015 D23 Expo, it was announced that a desert planet called Jakku from The Force Awakens would be added to the attraction. The new adventure became available beginning November 16th, 2015. The mineral planet Crate from The Last Jedi and Batuu, the remote outpost forest and mountain planet from Star Wars Galaxy's Edge, were added to the attraction on November 17th, 2017. The Ocean Moon Keef Beer from The Rise of Skywalker was added to the ride on December 20th, 2019, which was the film's release date, which was, I remember that. That was kind of a cool thing they did. It's like the day the film opens, you can see the new scene in Star Tours. Neat.
That is cool.
Star Tours continues to be the most up-to-date modular ride in the Disney toolkit, and it even has made several appearances within the Star Wars expanded universes. For example, in the PC game TIE Fighter, which was a long time ago, in the first TIE Interceptor historical mission, when the player uses sensors to identify a Lambda-class shuttle, its name reads Star Tour 7, and its cargo is listed as tourists. The Starspeeder 3000 has been referenced in the novel Spectre of the Past. The article Endor in the Model Sector in Star Wars Gamer 9 explains that a short-lived travel agency offered trips to Endor before accidents and mismanagement drove them out of business. It also suggests that those trips happened in the New Republic era. The article includes an illustration of a Starspeeder 3000 at a landing site on Endor. So, at least one made it to Endor. That's good. In the Star Wars Galaxies game, players encounter the crash site of the Star Tourist ship Zarina on Dathomir. I don't know why I'm talking like this. I secretly want to be a vampire. The crash is blamed on an incompetent droid captain who got too close to what sounds like the Battle of Yavin. The ride's G2 repair droids are featured in the new Essential Guide to Droids and are mentioned in the novel Spectre of the Past. Lightsaber Lost, in an episode of the Star Wars Clone Wars animated series, includes a holographic advertisement from Star Tours promoting travel to Glee Anselm. Droids in Distress, an episode of the Star Wars Rebels animated series, features the heroes traveling in a civilian transport vessel rather similar to the Starspeeder 3000, piloted by a droid of the same design as RX-24. And in fact, Paul Reubens reprised his role as the voice. going through the story of Star Tours, it really seems that Lucas is kind of the hero of Star Tours, and the Imagineers were just stuck in neutral. Not really, but also kind of really. George Lucas had a dream of transforming Tomorrowland into an actual creative destination for guests, and he did, bringing Star Tours and Captain EO, two iconic pieces of entertainment, to that section of the park. And I wonder what changes he would have made to Disneyland as a whole had he taken the CEO job all those years ago. It sounds like he knew exactly what audiences wanted and knew what would work and what wouldn't, except when it came to the Star Wars special edition releases or Star Wars prequels or Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull and basically anything else. But here he is talking about other things he was working on back in 1987.
Oh, yeah, I'm working on four or five other projects that will be coming out. Some of them Indiana Jones rides, some others intergalactic adventures.
That was it.
Oh.
Yeah, it's really, really small. However, kind of neat at the same time. Like, what were those projects? I mean, obviously the Indiana Jones, but what were the other intergalactic adventures?
Yeah.
I want to know.
Yeah.
Maybe the parks were like, we have enough. We have enough Star Wars stuff. Yeah, I don't know.
I think it was an intergalactic adventure of how to get another $1 million into his pocket.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, for sure. I mean, why not? Disney was like, look, we got a budget for George now. Anyway, that is the history of Star Tours, everybody.
Very, very cool.
Nice. Good job. That was a lot of information.
Yeah.
But I stayed with you.
Thanks, man.
Punch it! Punch it.
Yeah, it was cool. I mean, you know, I've always liked Star Tours and obviously Star Wars and whatever. I'm a passionate, you know, fan, which is why I don't like anything but the three movies, right?
Right.
But going through the history of Star Tours, and there's a lot more, like you can really get into the weeds about the lore, because Star Wars is all about lore and its fans want to read all of these notes and all of these backstories, all this stuff like Wookiepedia, which is like Wikipedia for Star Wars things. They have a whole lore about the design of the Starspeeder 3000, what planet it was made on, what the weapon system, where those were made from, and like who designed it and tested it, and it's this whole like complex thing.
I like how it's a like a transport ship for tourists, but it has guns on it. That's like our 747s coming equipped with missile launchers and stuff. Like.
Yeah, well, and I think in the Wikipedia article, I was referencing, they were like, it's something was like oddly overpowered, where it could explode, it could blow up a TIE fighter with one shot. It's like when you know, X-wings can't even really do that. So.
Yeah, and it's carrying civilians. It's like, no, it's okay, we'll protect you.
Yeah. But it's weird how much Star Tours transformed Tomorrowland.
Oh yeah.
Because if you think about, like, if Star Tours wasn't there, if it was just some other like what thing, I don't know if Tomorrowland would even be a thing. I mean, is Tomorrowland really a thing anymore, Eric? Do people care?
I mean, we constantly debate over what it could be, and some of those debates center around Star Tours and whether it should still be there now that we have a Star Wars land. That everybody, it's very polarizing in some ways. I still love riding it, especially at Disneyland, where there's seemingly almost never a line. It never, not the like sad way where there's nobody ever like I'm sure the People Mover was in the later days, or Horizons at Walt Disney World, where everybody's like, oh, well, we miss it so much. Well, you should have read. Gone on it.
Yeah. Everyone was there.
Yeah. Yeah. But I don't know. I think out of all of the Tomorrowland stuff, it's still something that is tomorrowly. And I will never accept the argument of, oh, it's a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away.
But it is.
Come on. It's future stuff.
But it is.
It's space.
I don't, yeah. But I mean, you know,
we don't have space. We barely have space. Well, billionaires and governments can go to space.
See, that's right. The problem is that Jason is thinking about time as being linear.
Okay, here we go.
No, that's the sentence.
Yeah.
That's it. Oh, okay. It's just time isn't necessarily always going to be linear.
It's like folding a circle.
But, yeah. Now, does anybody want to know how Rex came to be in Galaxy's Edge at Oga's Cantina?
Yes. What I did not mention is that DJ is Rex is now at Oga's Cantina. Yes. Serving up hot beats. Actually, he's still not a very good DJ, but...
Oh, my God. You missed our whole conversation.
No,
that
I didn't.
That is such...
I did it.
So wrong.
But he's over at Oga's Cantina. And, Eric, how did Rex get over there, please?
Well, we discussed it in a previous episode of The Supreme Resort in one of our... Part of our trilogy of Galaxy's Edge episodes, which is now grossly extended, as Rob knows.
Going to continue forever.
Yes. Yes, it will. It will continue. And apparently, Rex was piloting a different crew on a Star Tours tour, and that tour crashed on Batuu. The wreckage of that ship is in the land, and Rex was the only survivor, which is kind of dark. But Rex was reprogrammed. Somebody picked him up and reprogrammed him and made him a DJ at Oga's Cantina. Now, if you hang out in Oga's Cantina long enough, you might hear one of those flashbacks where Rex will flash back to the past and will kick into his pilot persona and go through some deep trauma and then get reset again and go back to DJ mode and everybody's happy again. Mildly traumatic and dark.
That's very funny.
I don't know how I feel about that.
It is dark. But I do kind of like, I mean, I just like that he's there.
Oh yeah. No, I think it's very cute. I think they did a great job. And Dan in the chat's going like, yeah, Star Tours is kind of my favorite thing about Star Wars. And he's sort of right. I mean, Star Wars does have a lot of really good serious moments, but it has a lot of just amazing characters, you know, funny or serious or somewhere in between or whatever. And that universe is so rich, it's hard to not want to tap into it. But I think Star Tours is probably the best thing that's come out since... you know, Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
I just haven't really liked anything as much as I've liked Star Tours.
Yeah.
You don't hear a lot of people complaining about the discrepancies. Sure, there's debate, but ultimately, people want to go to Hoth.
Yeah, they want to see all the things, and they don't care when.
And when you're in a flight simulator, there's nothing cooler than flying through the legs of the AT-AT, of the AT-AT, and being like, oh my gosh, I'm going to bang into it or whatever. So I have no problem with that. You know, the original Death Star blowing up the third Death Star, that's fine. I don't care, because that's what you want to do. You want to blow up something. You know, you want to you want to be in the movie, and this is the only way you could be in the movie. So I don't care that I'm blowing up a Death Star that doesn't exist. Do it anyway.
Yeah, we're going to do it anyway. I was going to do some news, but like, that's a lot of me talking, and nobody wants to hear that for that long.
Well, I think you did a great job. Thanks, man. Very thorough history.
Thanks, man. Appreciate it. It was fun. It's a good time.
Once again, it made me miss the parks and miss that ride.
Yeah, for sure. Well, our next show, we're going to have Bev back on to do Budget Bev Part 2, where we sent her to Disneyland and to see if she could survive on $30 for food.
We cut it down.
Because like she thought $60 or whatever it was, $75, I think. I forget how much it was 60, last time.
60.
She was like, oh yeah, it was easy to do. She had change.
Yeah.
Like, okay, well, let's try this again.
And she got like snacks and stuff.
Yeah.
Like
she can't be allowed to be snacking. She can't be snacking. No snacking, I'm not sure. So I want to see what's the lowest. And if she can do 30, I want to see if she could do 20.
That would be very hard.
I think she'd
be hungry.
Yeah.
So we're going to do that. We're going to talk about that. Talk about their trip to Disneyland in general and see what it's like to even go to the parks anymore.
Yeah.
Do sort of like a deep dive there. Eric, what's going on in Supreme Resort? Anything cool going on?
We're going for it after many months of talking about nonsense and Star Wars nonsense. We're getting back to the verses, and we're going to go for Pirates on the next one.
Oh.
Pirates versus what?
Pirates versus Pirates.
Pirates versus Pirates.
Oh, easy.
Yeah. And for some reason, I picked Walt Disney World. So let's see how I do.
My vote is Disney World.
It is.
It's a cooler Pirates. Just for the queue.
Stop it.
Just for the queue.
The queue is better.
Yeah.
I got that going for me.
Yeah.
But it doesn't. The queue, that part of the queue being better, doesn't equate to the amount that would be needed to make it better than Disneyland's.
I don't understand. Rob, anything going on in Bantha Milk? What's going on next for you guys?
We just had our Star Wars Day where we talked about all the great deals that are out there for Star Wars Day. So a lot of the sales and games, like all of the old games that you were referencing where that they mentioned things, they're all, they're still selling them, and they're all like 70-80% off right now. So you can, if you want to play any of those old Star Wars games, you can get them for like $10 or $20 now. So
I got to look and see if they got Star Wars Battlefield on Battlefront or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah.
That one.
Yep. And it's like 60% or 70% off. So you can get it.
All right. Cheap. That sounds great.
So that was our latest one. And we're getting ready for Obi-Wan Kenobi coming out.
The new
TV series on Disney Plus is coming out at the end of the month. So
I've yet to see the trailer for it, but they did like the teaser trailer a couple weeks ago, and now they think they just launched like the real trailer. I haven't seen it yet, but I'm excited for it. I think that'll be good. I'm happy about that. Yeah,
should be interesting. We had there was an author who wrote a book, Kenobi. I think it's behind me somewhere. But anyway, I can't see it there. Whatever, it doesn't matter. I forget the guy's name. I apologize. But he wrote a book called Kenobi where it took place in this time that now they're making the TV series about.
Oh, neat. That's cool.
I think they're doing things differently in the TV series than in the book. In the book, Obi-Wan Kenobi never pulled out his lightsaber when he was on Tatooine because he didn't want to be found out by, you know, anybody knowing that there's this Jedi out there.
Yeah.
So in the book, he never does that. But I'm pretty sure even in the trailers and in the poster, he has a lightsaber out.
Well, he has to. I mean, at that point, it's like the ride. It's like people want to go to Hoth. People want to see a Jedi with a lightsaber. That's just what it is.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks a lot, you guys, for joining us. I really appreciate it. Thank you guys for listening. And until next time, we'll see you in the parks.